Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Artworks representing animals, real or imaginary, religious or secular, span the full breadth and splendor of Japanese artistic production. As the first exhibition devoted to the subject, The Life of Animals in Japanese Art covers 17 centuries, from the 5th century to the present day, and a wide variety of media. At the symposium, held on June 7, 2019, in conjunction with the exhibition, Barbara Rossetti Ambrose spoke on the variety of roles animals have played in religious rituals in Japan, such as offerings and instruments of divination at Shinto shrines, as well as Buddhist mortuary rituals and life releases, in which the lives of animals destined for slaughter are saved. Ambrose described how religious views of animals influenced human interactions with animals through the example of Buddhist life releases and Kanyo Itai's early 19th century painting of such a ritual. Life releases served as a critique of prevalent social practices towards animals and demonstrated the virtues of compassion and filial piety.
With a recent animal turn in religious studies, scholars have begun to pay attention to the great variety of roles that animals have played in religious traditions, and not just symbolic and aesthetic ones, but as living animals in their material bodies and as actors in and subjects of religious practice. And to illustrate what I mean by that is when you go through the exhibit, you see all these wonderful silk kimono, and they depict animals on them. But when you think about it, the actual animal is the material that the robes are made of. So that's the animal that's actually staring at you right there. In my own research, I have been interested in the presence of animals in Japanese ritual practice, from hunting and fishing rituals to religious discourses about animal slaughter, to Buddhist animal releases and mortuary rituals. And in this presentation, I would like to focus on ritual animal releases, which have been a popular Buddhist ritual across East Asia for a millennium. Now, I had previously conducted fieldwork on several contemporary animal releases in Japan. The one that you're seeing here is held at Miidera in Otsu, and they're releasing native turtles, so they don't release any invasive species such as the red-eared sliders. And another animal release that I've worked on is the Gion Hojoe, where they release 2,000 fry into the Shirakawa River. So when I discovered an Edo period painting of an animal release among the works to be included in this exhibition, I was immediately intrigued. The painting I'm referring to was produced in the early 19th century by Kano Etai, a painter in the Kano school. The painting features a verse of praise composed by the Rinzai Zen cleric Shinjo Genmyo, the abbot of Kenchoji in Kamakura. And the inscription is dated 1829 and identifies the scene as Master Junshō Daisho's life release rite, or Hojoe. And you can see here my translation of the verse up on top. Ah, the old venerable had a very compassionate heart. Flying birds spread their wings in the sky. Fish run along the waves. What kind of karmic reward is rebirth in a horse's stomach or a donkey's womb? Wild cats and white oxen realize great wisdom. Pitiful living beings in the path of beasts suffer useless distress, never having made the vow to contemplate Amitabha. So it's Amitabha Buddha. An oversized Junshō, clad in a colorful brocade robe, dominates the center of the painting. Standing on a sandy beach next to an open body of water, he's leading a service, while a group of lay people are clasping rosaries and kneeling with folded hands before the cleric. The gathering includes men of diverse social stations. And in reflection of her low social status, the single woman in the group is depicted as physically smaller, as is the beggar in a tattered robe, who has his back turned to the group and watches a Buddhist nun in a black robe release multiple species of birds from baskets. Above Junshō, a man in a boat is releasing saltwater fish into the sea. And on the water's edge below, two laymen are liberating freshwater fish and turtles. Beside them, a large black ox is drinking water, while a piebald bovine above it and a horse on the opposite side of the two men have their heads turned toward Junshō, as if listening to his words. Now, the oversized presence of the black and piebald bovines and other details in the image are an explicit allusion to Junshō's Hōjō Yorokobi Gusa, or Jottings on the Joys of Releasing Life, which was produced in 1816, a work that extols the karmic benefits of life releases. The text features these two oxen in two lengthy tales about a pious laywoman and a Pure Land nun who saved the animals from slaughter. Moreover, Hōjō Yorokobi Gusa promotes releasing animals of all kinds, a fact also reflected in Kano Etai's image. And if you look very closely, these are all native species that have some kind of cultural significance. If you look at the wild animals there, you can see there's a boar up on top, and then a male and female deer, a moon bear, a couple of rabbits, a fox, weasel, a macaque, a raccoon, dog, a mouse, snake, centipede, praying mantis, a grasshopper, a crab, and a frog down below. Now, these wild animals and insects have their backs turned toward the men and are escaping toward a large pine tree on Junshō's left. Like the birds, wild animals and insects are drawn in precise detail. And the presence of insects, a rat, frog, and a snake, are another visual reference to Junshō's text, which states that even a pauper can liberate countless numbers of living beings without spending even a copper coin by releasing fleas, lice, mosquitoes, ants, crickets, horseflies, bees, dragonflies, frogs, rats, and snakes. Like Junshō's Hōjō Yorokobi Gusa, Kano Etai's painting appeared in the context of a revival of life release rituals that began in the 17th century due to the influence of contemporaneous Chinese Buddhism. Now, animals have played important and complex roles in Japanese religious history. Animals have been regarded as potentially powerful spiritual forces, but attitudes toward them have varied widely across the species and depending on the historical context. Animals were assumed to have not only benign powers, but also demonic agency, which was often the topic of mythology and folklore. Animals were associated with Buddhist and Shinto deities. Animals, especially game and fish, served as ritual offerings at Shinto shrines, and hunting and fishing were replete with folk religious practices to counteract the dangers of the professions and to mitigate karmic retribution associated with killing. In pre-modern Japan, game meat, poultry, and fish were the primary sources of animal protein in the Japanese diet, as the meat of livestock was considered more ritually polluting. And as in late imperial China, there was a special taboo against the consumption of beef because oxen were considered too important as draft animals in agriculture, and human kin were often said to be reborn as the family's livestock to work off karmic debts. And Keller has a really interesting article that gives some stories that illustrate this really nicely. Now, despite taboos against the meat of livestock, medieval and early modern warrior culture necessitated leather for use in military equipment. So think about that when you walk through the exhibit and you look at some of the armor that the horse is wearing. I don't know if this is horse hide or cow hide or what kind of hide this is, but I think it's pretty interesting. And the butchering of livestock and tanning hides fell to stigmatized outcast populations. I'll get back to that later in the talk. Pre-modern Japanese attitudes toward animals were strongly influenced by continental Asian religions, especially Buddhism, and pre-Buddhist Chinese traditions. Now, in the Buddhist tradition, animals were viewed both as kin and as radically other. They were considered living, sentient beings able to attain salvation, and killing them was understood to have negative karmic consequences. Simultaneously, however, animals were believed to occupy an inferior realm of existence than that of humans, though animals could be reborn as humans and vice versa. The animal realm was one of the three lower, so-called evil paths, in the six realms of existence, along with those of hell and hungry ghosts. And if you look at this particular slide, you can see the six realms. If you draw a line from the Deva realm to the human realm, everything below depicts the six realms of existence, and these four existences above have escaped the cycle of death and rebirth, so they're sort of outside that. Rebirth in this realm, full of suffering, defilement, and violence, the animal realm, constituted a karmic punishment for evil deeds. Birth in the animal realm meant living in a world in which the strong devoured the weak, and humans forced animals to perform labor for them and hunted or slaughtered them for food. And you see this kind of illustrated in this depiction of the animal realm. There are a couple of animals that have, here for instance, a bird has captured a snake, a tiger is attacking some other animals, potentially dogs or jackals. And then there's a horse and an ox standing by the side, and these were the typical animals used for labor and agriculture and transport. And then you have some fish and a body of water. Now, in pre-Buddhist Chinese traditions, animals and humans were thought to share blood, breath, and cognition. But only humans were considered capable of moral conduct. Yet both animals and humans were thought to reflect the principles of heaven and earth. Therefore, some Chinese thinkers came to believe that even animals were capable of rudimentary morality. In pre-Buddhist Chinese traditions and in Chinese Buddhism, animals were crucial to ritual traditions. For instance, animal bones were used in divination as early as the Shang Dynasty. And I should say that in Japan, they were also used for the same purpose in certain Shinto lineages, some to this day. Animals, especially livestock, served as sacrificial victims. Now, Buddhism introduced to China strong arguments against killing animals and, by implication, against animal sacrifice and meat eating. And despite a more lenient position in the Buddhist monastic precepts that allowed the consumption of meat under certain circumstances, Mahayana Buddhist scriptures propagated anti-meat eating discourses that eventually led to vegetarianism becoming normative for the Chinese Buddhist clergy and an aspirational ideal for the Buddhist laity. Now, in the 5th and 6th centuries, discourses against killing and meat eating led to the development of a new ritual, the ritual release of animals, called fangsheng, or in Japanese, hojo, life releases, which did not exist in Indian Buddhism. This ritual drew on a number of Buddhist scriptures, but the most influential ones were the Golden Light Sutra and the Brahmanet Sutra. The former, first translated into Chinese in the early 5th century, provided ritual templates for life release liturgies, while the latter, composed in China around the same time, depicted the practice as an expression of filial piety. Life releases appealed to lay and monastic practitioners by combining the rhetoric of filial piety with the promise of karmic rewards. From the 6th century onward, eminent monks and pious laity from the literate elites conducted life releases. This included members of the royalty, such as the Liang Emperor Wu, who is known for promoting Buddhist vegetarianism and banning animal sacrifice. The 6th century Tiantai monk Juri is credited with establishing the first life release ponds, and the Tang Emperor Suzong is said to have established 81 such ponds throughout his realm after the devastating Andushan Rebellion in the mid-8th century. that the practice of life, releasing life, underwent periodic revivals, particularly in the 10th and 11th and the 16th and 17th century, and it has retained its appeal for the contemporary Chinese Buddhist laity. And there's one Chinese scholar who's made this interesting argument that it's so appealing because it really relies on affect. It stirs the emotions to go and get your animals in the marketplace, live animals, to capture them from hell and release them in paradise in a park or at a Buddhist temple. Now, soon after their inception in China, life releases spread to Japan, where Buddhism had been introduced in the mid-6th century. As in China, life releases in ancient Japan were either large-scale state-sponsored rituals or sporadic acts of personal piety. In Japan, they functioned as rites of spirit pacification, and since the 8th century, they were often held at shrines dedicated to the deity of war, Hachiman, where the ritual transformed into a combinative Shinto-Buddhist rite. While life releases flourished from the 8th to 15th century, we should not assume that the rhetoric against killing and for releasing life exclusively shaped human-animal relationships in Japan at the time. Contemporaries found creative ways of justifying hunting and fishing despite the rhetoric against killing animals by arguing, for example, that these animals were offerings at Shinto shrines, such as the Suwa shrine, which you see here up here, where they have offered some deer heads. And the recitation of an esoteric formula, such as the Suwa Nomon, during the hunt allowed the animals to attain a better rebirth more quickly. And that the falcons used during hunting were bodhisattvas who absorbed the karmic consequences of the kill. Moreover, scholars have noted that the welfare of the released animals was not a primary concern in large state-sponsored life release ceremonies. About one-third of the fish, often numbering in the thousands, would die in captivity before the life release ritual. Therefore, it was necessary to procure large numbers of fish to ensure that there were enough left for the release. But the ultimate goal of the ritual was not to extend the natural lifespan of the animals, but to ensure their posthumous salvation. Since the birth of an animal was considered an unfortunate existence, a natural death followed by a more fortunate rebirth, in Triastrimsa heaven, for instance, was regarded as much more preferable than leading a long and comfortable life as an animal. In the wake of the Onin War in the mid to late 15th century, as Japan descended into protracted warfare, the most famous life release conducted at the Iwashimizu Hachiman Shrine in Kyoto, which you see depicted here, was suspended for 2 centuries due to the shogunate's and the court's lack of economic and political power. However, life releases underwent a revival in the relatively peaceful Edo period thanks to the influence of contemporaneous Chinese Buddhism. In China, the Buddhist cleric Zhu Hong, who lived in the late Ming Dynasty, so late 1500s into the early 1600s, combined Chan and Pure Land practices. He not only worked to revitalize Buddhist monasticism, but also was a staunch proponent of vegetarianism and ritual life releases. In addition to referring life releases in many of his writings, he composed 2 texts that were exclusively devoted to the topic, including his influential Jiesha Fangshengwen, or Tract on Refraining from Killing and Releasing Life, and a liturgy for life releases that would become the standard format for these rituals in China during the centuries that followed. And just incidentally, the slide that you're seeing up here is a life release pond that's just off West Lake in Hangzhou, and this is where Zhu Hong was active. For Zhu Hong, animal welfare during and after life releases was an important matter of concern. He issued a variety of instructions to his disciples that were meant to safeguard the well-being of the released animals. And thanks to Zhuhang's leadership, life releases became a popular practice in Chinese literati circles. After the fall of the Ming Dynasty in 1644, several Chan Buddhist clerics from southern China migrated to Japan, where they established the Obaku Zen school. In the process, these Chinese clerics transmitted Zhuhong's thought on refraining from killing and releasing life. While descriptions of life releases have been scattered sporadically across medieval didactic tale collections, they only appeared as a single standing topic of Buddhist tracts after Zhuhong's works were published in Japan in the mid-17th century. And until the end of the Edo period, almost a dozen tracts appeared in Japanese that were inspired by Zhuhong's Jiesha Fengshengwen. These works were compiled by clerics from a variety of Buddhist denominations, suggesting that the ethic of refraining from killing and releasing life had a transsectarian appeal. Now, the initial resurgence of the interest in refraining from killing and releasing life occurred in a political climate that supported both life releases and animal welfare. The Iwashimizu Hachiman Life Release Festival was reinstated in 1679 under Shogun Ietsuna, and a successor, Shogun Tsunayoshi, promulgated far-reaching animal protection laws during the three decades of his reign, which coincided with the publication of the first Japanese tracts on refraining from killing and releasing life. The most stringent of Tsunayoshi's animal protection laws were soon repealed by his successor and had little lasting effect. But the concept of refraining from killing and releasing life remained influential in Buddhist circles. Junshō's Hōjō Yorokobigusa from 1816 emerged in the context of this Edo period revival of life releases. Little is known about the author of the work, other than that his full name was Nen'a Junshō, and that he was the abbot of a Pure Land temple called Seiganji in southern Kyoto. He was also closely tied into Pure Land networks in nearby Otsu, and may have served as the abbot of a temple there before moving to Kyoto Seiganji. Junshō's Hōjō Yorokobigusa consists of three main sections. The first extols the benefits of life releases and provides a simple liturgy for the ritual. The second demonstrates the negative karmic consequences of killing living beings. And the third comprises seven discourses, including three stories about pious lay devotees who practice life releases, and four chapters on wholesome conduct related to the virtues cultivated by these rituals. Now, the first and second sections in particular draw on a variety of Buddhist, Confucian, Shinto sources to make the case that releasing life leads to karmic rewards, extended lifespans, protection from illness, good fortune, and prosperous descendants, while killing results in karmic retribution, poverty, starvation, severe illness, disabled children, rebirth as animals, and torments in hell. Hayami Shungyosai's illustrations of Junshō's text graphically contrast the karmic consequences of life releases and killing animals. And you see here the illustrations from that book. A couple who release fish over here, so the woman's releasing birds and the man is releasing fish and turtles. So a couple who release fish and birds are blessed with a prosperous and healthy multi-generational household. You can see this here. By contrast, a couple who kill animals to consume them are facing terrible karmic retribution, forced to live in a dilapidated house littered with broken dishes while debt collectors come calling. The couple and the disabled children suffer from illness and starvation. I think there's a really hard image to take, actually, if you look at the way that the children are depicted up here. Their karmic offenses are clearly visible. A hunting rifle, up here, is mounted on the crumbling wall, while an animal leg, down here, and an eel and a turtle that are being dispatched by a spiking tool and a knife are depicted in the image. After death, the torments of hell await the human culprits. Demons boil them in a large pot, just like the creatures the humans consumed during their previous lives. Now, Junchō's text closely linked eating meat with poverty. But actually, the kinds of people who ate meat were usually those who could afford it. Now, fish was readily consumed in Japan, but meat too, despite taboos and prohibitions against meat eating at the time, was consumed. And people ate it claiming that it was for medicinal purposes, or in Edo, so-called momonjiya or kimonodana, beast markets, which sold game meat, used creative euphemisms, and they were mostly located in the Kojimachi district and in East Ryogoku Bridge. And what you can see here is one sign that reads Yamakujira, so mountain whale, and that's actually a euphemism for boar meat. And then this one here is interesting. This has the writing for momiji, which means maples, and botan, which means peony, but what they're referring to is deer meat and boar meat. So Kanoetai's painting focuses entirely on the joyous practice of releasing animals and omits the negative karmic consequences of killing. The painting draws especially on the first two stories in section three, how, with the help of her husband, a woman called Isa from Fushimi saved a young black ox from slaughter after the animal had injured its leg and had become unable to perform farm labor, and how the Nanjōshō was inspired by Junchō's text to rescue an old piebald bovine, and before her death found a man willing to take care of the animal. The two bovines are prominently featured in the painting. Furthermore, the painting also depicts the Nanjōshō releasing birds. That the black-robed cleric in the painting is indeed a depiction of the Nanjōshō is suggested by the beggar who is looking toward her in the proximity of the piebald ox. Junchō's text explains that Jōshō not only released living beings, but she also always gave clothes to those who were cold, shared food with those who were starving, and showed kindness toward beggars. As Joanna Hanlon-Smith argues, Chinese literati during this time understood life releases as metaphors for showing benevolence, not only to animals, but also to the poor and other weak elements in society. Now, Junchō and Kanoetai's painting seemed to be making a similar point, even though Junchō also linked poverty to sinfulness. It's sort of an uneasy contrast. It's important to note that Junchō's work showed concern for the welfare of animals being liberated, but ultimately assumed that the most important benefit for the animals was their salvation. Junchō stated, for instance, that when releasing fish and birds, one should simply chant Amida Buddha's name and a short scripture such as a spell. When saving the lives of animals that were more resilient, such as dogs, cats, mice, snakes, rabbits, deer, oxen, and horses, Junchō recommended that one should conduct a full service by sprinkling water, chanting incantations and mantras, forming mudras, bestowing the three refuges, and chanting sutras in Amitabha Buddha's name. He claimed that Zhuhong made these recommendations because the latter witnessed that fish and birds would be weakened, suffer pain, and die if scripture recitation was not kept short, and that the animals were not released quickly. And this is sort of, it bears out to some of the things that I mentioned earlier, that especially in some of the big state rites, often a lot of the animals died. Junchō added that after the release, one should recite a merit transfer for the benefit of the released beings so that they could be reborn out of their condition of constant suffering into the bliss of Amitabha's Pure Land. While liberating animals did not mean that their physical well-being was guaranteed from there on after, the karmic benefits of the release were supposed to help the animals in future existences. Other humans might recapture the released animals. Quote, however, if after they have been released, these beasts fall again into the hands of humans and lose their lives, Because they remember the recitation of Amida Buddha's name, they will attain liberation for too long. So the assumption was that the animals had a recollection of the ritual. The ultimate goal of life releases was about the animal's salvation, rather than merely intended to extend the animal's existence in this world. And this is quite interesting when you go and visit the Gion Hojoe on the Shirakawa. It seems to me that actually the wildlife nearby is aware of what's going on. So when I walked to the site, a heron came flying and landed downstream. And then as soon as they released all the fish, he started picking off all the fish. And all the people who are watching this were aware of this because once the life release ritual was done, they started taking pictures of the heron with the fish in his mouth. And then as the ritual was over, I decided to leave, and the heron also decided to leave and flew downstream where the Shirakawa flows into the Kamo River. And once I got there, there were a bunch of herons and crows, and they were all picking out the fish. So anyway, in conclusion, life releases are an example of how Japanese Buddhism concretely shaped human interactions with animals, sometimes for the better and sometimes for the worse. Some rituals offered humans opportunities to cultivate compassion toward animals. Within a Japanese Buddhist worldview, as in Buddhism in general, animals occupied a realm of existence full of suffering that was regarded as inferior to the human realm. While the Buddhist tradition thus naturalized animal suffering as karmically ordained, it also recognized animals as living beings, sentient beings that have the potential for salvation. As Shinzo's inscription of Kanoetai's painting implied, rebirth as an animal exposes living beings to great suffering and limits their potential to better their karmic lot. Yet even such unenlightened beings as wild cats and white oxen can attain wisdom. Therefore, animals should not be harmed or killed, but ought to receive ritual care by compassionate humans, such as the Venerable Junshō, so that they might be freed from the beastly realm in a future existence. Life releases were a way in which humans could help animals find salvation. At the same time, they gave the human participants an opportunity to accrue merit, which would manifest itself concretely in this life and the next. While life releases were meant to save living beings from certain death, they often placed vulnerable beings in precarious situations and did not guarantee their long-term welfare. Early modern Buddhist clerics were aware of such problems, but ultimately emphasized the karmic benefits of such rituals for humans and animals alike. Life releases were not uniquely Japanese, but existed within a larger East Asian continuum. Kanoetai's image of a life release and Junshō's Hōjō Yorokobi Gusa were composed in the context of an early modern revival of life releases influenced by contemporaneous Chinese Buddhism. It's also important to point out that life releases in Japan, like those on the Asian continent, existed within a predominant culture that habitually consumed and killed animals. Hence, proponents of the life releases not only found eager patrons, but also faced criticism and resistance from their contemporaries. Rather than being representative examples of human-animal relationships in Asia, life releases served as a critique of prevalent social practices and a public opportunity to demonstrate the virtues of compassion and filial piety. And I'd like to end here.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.